going forward for what's left, because I've gotten a few emails this week about that. So realistically, I think we are going to need, today is June 8th, right? So I think we're going to need 8th, the 15th, and at least part of the 22nd to get to the end of Megillat Rut. And that depends in part on, you know, how much space you give me in terms of, being able to get through it. But 8th, 15th, and part of the 22nd at least. The 29th, I'm not able to give a shiur, but what I think I might do is tack on an Eicha shiur, because we did hope to do Eicha, so to speak. No one hopes to do Eicha, but we had hoped to learn Eicha. So maybe tack on a shiur on July 6th for those who are able to participate on Eicha. And that way we'll have done something from Eicha at least. But we'll see.
Rabbi,
yes.
Thank you for persevering and not giving up on us.
Oh, no. Are you kidding? You didn't give up on me. Why would I give up on you?
Right.
But that's in terms of the weeks ahead. We have a lot to talk about, some very, very interesting things, which I suspect are going to lead to a lot of discussion.
Realistically, two books.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I sent Joyce and Rebecca my ideas for next, and based on the possibilities that I floated to them, I think we're looking at the arc of King Solomon, the first 11 chapters of Malachim,
okay.
I think, is what we're looking at. The Alina, I'm not worried about overlap with the shiur at your house. So given that we're still, in Shmuel Aleph, we're not, we will not hit Malachim next year. We're good. Okay. So we'll see. I mean, that's just, among the topics I sent them, that's the one that seems most likely. And, Susan, 11 chapters, I hope we can do.
Yeah. I'm saying, but when you said three books, and I said I don't think so, you looked at me like I'm crazy.
Okay.
Three books was a
lot. Hey, you know we did two.
Okay.
So, in any case, let's get started for today. Again, thank you to Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating for the year, as well as let's dedicate learning also in honor of Mendy Kanofsky for his swearing in today into Tzanchanim. All right, so what I want to cover for today is the topic we started last week of Boaz's reaction to Ruth and the fact that he does not go for what Dr. Ziegler thought was Naomi's plan, and I think there's a lot to be said for that position, of seducing Boaz. In other words, the idea is that Ruth is supposed to complete the matter with Boaz there in the granary, and Boaz resists. And we're going to talk about that. I also want to talk about the term Eshet Chayil that Boaz uses in praising Rut and the fact that it was also used as a description of Boaz, Gibor Chayil, in the beginning of chapter 2. And then the next topic I want to talk about is the six barleys that Boaz gives Rut at the end of the chapter. In the offing, we're not getting there today, but I gave you the note, the sources on the source sheet, is a discussion about all the weird missing words and extra words that show up in this chapter, the issue of kri uktiv in Tanakh. I had a fun time exploring this one. We've got four different explanations that go end to end in their philosophy for why you have this in the text. So we're not getting that today, but it's in the source sheet already, so those who wish to look ahead will be able to look ahead. But let's go back to Boaz's reaction to Ruth, right? We saw that you could suggest that Naomi was simply telling Ruth to go there and submit herself to Boaz's authority, or, per Dr. Ziegler, the idea is no, she's actually supposed to seduce Boaz, modeled on the daughters of Lot with their father, modeled on Tamar with Yehuda. But Boaz doesn't go for it. And the simple read of Boaz's reaction, we said this last time, is Boaz is a really righteous man, and he overcomes his Yetzer Hara. He is inclined, and he says no. And we supported that with the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which compares him with, well, it contrasts him really with Yosef and with Palti ben Laish, right? It says that his challenge was greater than that of Yosef, but not as great as Palti ben Laish. We have the Medrash in Rut Rabbah that Boaz freezes himself in place so that he won't act. We saw that the Midrashim talk about him swearing Chai Hashem against his Yetzer Hara. I also will note something that we mentioned a while back in the beginning of the book when we talked about whether Boaz is, or not the beginning, the beginning of chapter 2, when we talked about whether Boaz is Ivtzan. So the commentary on Divrei Hayamim that is labeled Rashi, but likely is not Rashi, comments that Ivtzan stands for Av Lechol Hatzinunim, father to all of those who would make themselves cold, in the sense that he didn't act on the opportunity that he had with Ruth. So that's all one way to read this. But Dr. Ziegler offers us a remarkable insight here. Also taught me a new word, a word that I did not know. Tell me something. Israelis, this one. Non-Israelis. Can you translate for me the word litarpeid? Lamed tet resh pei dalet. Bingo. Bingo. Litarpeid is to torpedo. Exactly. It was Dr. Ziegler's word for what Boaz did to Naomi's plan. He was mitarpeid the tochnit. So what she suggests, I think, is really interesting. She tells us to focus on chapter 3, sentence 9. So take a look there, please. Perek Gimel Pasuk Tet. This is when Boaz has found a woman lying at his feet. Vayomer mi'at. He says, who are you? Vatomer, and she replied, as we've seen, Anochi Rut Amatecha, I am Rut, your maidservant. Ufarastachinafecha al amatecha. Again, she calls herself maidservant. You should spread your cloak over me. We talked about that term already. Ki go elata, because you are the Redeemer. So she argues that we need to look closely at the word that is used, the words that Boaz uses. Specifically, he says, mi'at. He says, who are you? Now, you look at that and say, okay, he said, who are you? Why is that such a big deal? But the answer is that it's a very big deal. It actually reminds me of something with Yosef, which I'm just making a note so that I'll come back to it. During the period of the Shoftim, which is the era when this story takes place, women... I'm sorry, I'm going to mute everybody by default. I'm getting background noise. During this period of the Shoftim, women are often abused. You can sense that in the overall immorality which riddles the entire book, but also in particular stories in Sefer Shoftim. Can you give me an example of women being abused or treated as an object in the book of Shoftim? So Pilegish Begiv'ah is a perfect example of it on both ends. In other words, the very fact that you have a Pilegish in the first place, which when we learned Sefer Shoftim, those who learned it with me, we spent some time talking about that, the very existence of a Pilegish, of a concubine, which is essentially marriage without all the protections of marriage. Then, when there's a threat to them in the town, the husband, for lack of a better word for him, hands her over, and then she's raped and she dies. So that's an obvious example of this kind of treatment of women. Where else in Sefer Shoftim? There are numerous zonot in Sefer Shoftim. Yiftach is born to a zonah. Shimshon is with a zonah in Aza. And then what Sisera was going to do to Yael, right? When Sisera runs away, the plan, it seems fairly clear for what Sisera is planning on doing to Yael. And not only that, but you get Sisera's mother, right, who consoles herself when her son isn't there, saying, oh, don't worry about it, he's off raping women. This is something that is dominant in the culture in that era. Women are essentially treated as objects. And then you get to Boaz. Go back to chapter 2, sentence 5. When Boaz comes out to the field, and he greets his harvesters, right? And then Boaz says to the Na'ar, Lemi hana'ara hazot. Who is she? With whom is she associated? He wants her identity. And Ruth is stunned. If you take a look at Pasuk Yud, sentence 10 in chapter 2, Vatipol alpaneh vatishtachu artza, she falls on her face, she bows to the ground. Vatomer elav, and she says to him, not thank you for giving me food, which she did in the intervening psukim, right? He said, you know, you can take from the, from where everybody else gets their food, and you can glean whatever you want. That's not what she says. She says, Madua matzasi chein beinecha lahakireni. How is it that I found favor in your eyes that you identify me? It's the identification as a person that she picks up on. You follow? Boaz sees her as a human being. And now here, in Pasuk Ted, in sentence 9, Boaz's reaction to the woman at his feet in the granary is to ask, Mi'at, who are you? And lest you say, what's the big deal in asking who are you? If Lot had asked who are you, that story doesn't happen. If Yehuda had asked Tamar, who are you? That story does not happen. So Dr. Ziegler makes this point, which I think is really brilliant, that unlike with those two other stories, Boaz doesn't fall into the trap. He cares to know who she is, and by doing that, he breaks with the period of the Shoftim. You follow? What I wanted to mention from Yosef is just that this reminds me of Yosef in the jail. Right? The comment is made, I think it's usually made in the name of various Hasidic rabbis. I don't know who was the one who said it. But the entire story of Yosef, his whole sort of parabola, right, changes when he sees that the butler and the baker are zo'afim, they're upset in the prison, and he asks, what's wrong? He takes the time to say, what's wrong? Just the fact that you do, he says, Madua p'nechem ra'im hayom, why are you upset today? Just the fact of taking the time to ask that question changes the story. You follow? So Boaz doing this here is the, is what changes what happens in this story. Follow? Okay. So that's in terms of Boaz. Which brings us to the Eshes Chayil. So the term Chayil is a really difficult term to translate. It's clearly a very important word in this Megillah, right? In chapter 2, Boaz was introduced as Ish Gibor Chayil. Here, Ruth is an Eshet Chayil. And if you jump ahead to chapter 4, sentence 11, in sentence 11, the women of the city, actually no, the people in general at the city, give a blessing, Asei Chayil Be'efrata, when Boaz and Ruth are going to get married, Asei Chayil Be'efrata, perform Chayil in Efrata, what that place is we may talk about when we get to chapter 4. But the point is that Chayil is clearly a key word. Looking at my source sheet, I just realized I skipped. I had brought you an excerpt from Dr. Ziegler making the point about Boaz's reaction. Let's take a fast look at it, just to see her words. Habeirur shel Boaz legabe zehuta shel Ruth mafti'a kan bimyuchad. Boaz clarifying Ruth's identity is especially surprising here. V'zos bishashev b'kach sheyeshna avira minit ti'una. Because what you have is a loaded sexual atmosphere at this point in the story. And realistically, women were looked at as objects in the period of the Shoftim, like we've talked about. She doesn't give illustrations, but I gave you the illustrations. He says, Boaz's question has the opposite result for Ruth. Instead of being treated as an object, it enabled Ruth to restore her identity. I don't know, making her something more than an object. So that was the. Sorry, what?
Did he not know who she was?
I think that's the idea. That at the moment in the granary,
he
has
no. She was. It's not. not like he wanted to make her feel.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think he has no idea. I could be wrong about that.
And would he have acted differently had she not been fruit?
So I think not. I think he would not have treated her differently. Meaning, that's the point. He asks who is it before he knows who she is. In other words, he cares to ask no matter who this is.
So it's not her identity that makes him act that way. It's anybody that he
That's my sense of it. That's my sense of it, yeah.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity, do you hear a beep in the background? There is a beep in the background here, and I just don't know if it's as annoying to you the way it's annoying to me. The problem is you can't close a door because of, you know, COVID. So, all right, we'll deal. If it's not bothering you, then I will live with it. So take a look on the sheet at source number 2, where I try to show you the word chayil is used in multiple contexts around Tanakh, and translations render it in many context-specific ways. But I want to see if we can come up with a broader English word that translates chayil. I'm not going to ask you now to translate chayil, because I want you to see the psukim first, and because I really don't want anybody to say valor. So take a look at source number 2. That's why I gave you a list. First example that I bring here is when Moshe is supposed to select judges. Ve'ata sechazem yikol ha'am anshei chayil yirei elokim anshei emes sonei batza. And you should identify from the nation anshei chayil who are yirei elokim, God-fearing, anshei emet, men of truth, son e batza, people who despise profit. So what does chayil mean in that sentence?
I like steadfast.
What makes you think it's steadfast in that sentence?
Because he stands for what he stands. He's consistent.
Okay. So, in other words, just because we're talking about people who will be people of truth and God-fearing, so that conveys a certain identity, and steadfast will be consistent with that. Okay. Could be. Anybody else want to hazard something? Or is Gita the only brave one?
Honorable.
Okay, I hear that. Ibn Ezra is with Gita. Ibn Ezra says, people who will work in their role doggedly and fearlessly. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, an early authority, says, people who pursue truth. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 3 for a moment, Radak is commenting on a pasuk in Melachim, which we're going to see momentarily. Actually, you may as well see it now. If you take a look at source number 2, this is when Yoav is speaking, well, he was speaking, and then Yonatan ben Aviatar shows up, and Adoniyahu gives him a compliment. So, v'hinei Yonatan ben Aviatar ha-kohen ba v'yomer Adoniyahu bo, ki ish chayel ata v'tov tivaser. Adoniyahu gives a compliment to Yonatan ben Aviatar ha-kohen. Remember, Adoniyahu had a coup going against King David. So Adoniyahu gives a compliment to Yonatan, and his compliment is Ish Chayil Ata V'Tov Tivaser. But that doesn't tell me what it means. You are an Ish Chayil, and you'll give me good news. What is an Ish Chayil? So Radak in source number 3 says it means energetic and good. Sort of like the steadfast idea, maybe sort of. And I suspect this is the origin of the Women of Valor translation for Eshet Chayil. Like, this all fits with valor. So Radak is in 3. He's commenting on a verse in source 2. Moish, what were you going to say to translate Anshei Chayil in source number 2? Because I know you were about to do that, and then I went over to the next one.
I think that Chayil is a generic term that means multi or multiplicity to be applied by the context, and that in the particular first one you mentioned, there it means multi-talented.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that chayil just means multiple of something, and then it depends on what the situation is. That's what you're saying?
Like the first chayil I think about is Nimrod. Gibor chayil.
He's not a Gibor chayil. He's Gibor Tzayid.
Sorry, okay, I apologize. Wrong on that. Okay.
The problem that I have with what you're suggesting is that it's only used in the positives. We never find chayil used in a negative. So it can't just be multiple. It has to be a positive multiple, no?
As I said to you, I didn't mean that disrespectfully. In other words, the word itself is context driven.
But it's never used in a negative.
I can't answer that question.
Okay. Devi, then Ruchama, then Gita.
In English, when we want to talk about positive attributes in any area, we talk about things of substance, a person of substance, an act of substance. And I think if you use that word substance in each one of these translations, my Hebrew is dreadful.
So I am glad to say Baruch Shekivanti, because at
what
the end of
mean?
Baruch Shekivanti means, thank God I came to the same conclusion that you did. It's something you say when you read a brilliant insight, and it's actually something you had also thought of. So you say Baruch Shekivanti. That's actually the exact English word that I have come to use is for Eshet Chayil, woman of substance, is, I believe, a correct translation. But let me go around to everybody else first, and then I'll explain more about this, because we still have more psukim to see. Ruchama and then Gita. I don't hear you, Ruchama. You're not muted, but I don't hear you. You're not muted. If you see on your screen where it says mute, there should be an arrow. And if you click that arrow, it'll offer you options for selecting a microphone. You might need to do something with that. I don't know, but I can't hear you, and you're not muted. Gita?
No, when we got to the word energetic, I keep thinking about Chayil as in Chayilim.
So we are going to talk about soldiers. We're not quite there yet. Actually, we are right there. Take a look at source number 2. Look at my third sentence. Vatihi Yisrael shmona mayot elef ish chayil, sholef cherev, and so on. The Jews were 800,000 ish chayil, swordsmen, and you see the rest of the sentence. So there are many uses in which chayil is a reference to military prowess, to soldiers, to strength, and that's another piece of it. On the other hand, continuing in source number 2, look at the fourth pasuk I brought you there, which is from Divrei Hayamim. I'm just trying to figure out why I put the Divrei Hayamim one first. I think I do this every time I talk about chayil. Sorry. Skip to the fifth one. Chelcha ve'otzrosecha lavaz etein. This is a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, in which the Jews are warned that Hashem is going to give their wealth as spoils. And their wealth is identified as chayil. So that, going back to the first sentence that we quoted, the one about the judges, Anshei Chayil, Rashi there actually says, Anshei Chayil means people of wealth, so that they will not be bribable. They won't be vulnerable to bribes. So you have a meaning of chayil that is about that. Now, I got a note here in the chat that some are using Samsung devices, which are experiencing audio issues. Samsung will hopefully correct this shortly. Okay, I hope so, for all of our sake. But you have another use here meaning wealth. So far we have this very strong positive character, steadfast, dogged, working at it, and so on. We have physical strength. There's wealth as well. And then finally, the pasuk I brought you in Divrei Hayamim, it's the last one listed, the next to last one listed in source number 2. It's describing the sons of Oved Edom. Oved Edom had the ark, the Aron, in his house. And his sons are described here as Va'achayhem ish chayil bekoach la'avodah. They were ish chayil with strength to work. And in the Pseudo-Rashi commentary to Divrei Hayamim, it means people who are respected, specifically. So to me, Chayil reflects, and this may go back a little bit towards what Moish was saying as well, the positive connotations of some or all of these traits. a strong positive character, physical strength, respected in society, wealth. This is a person of substance. And all of these definitions fit something about Ruth. Either where she is in the beginning of the story, or what she gains along the way. She starts out with two of these, right? She starts out with righteousness, as demonstrated by taking care of Naomi and joining the Jewish people. And she starts out with physical strength, right? She's going out gleaning, roughing it in the field. That's already there in the beginning. She acquires wealth when she marries Boaz, right, the landowner. And she earns the respect of everybody around her. First Naomi, then Boaz, who praises her as an Eshet Chayil and says everybody knows this about her. So Ruth has the gamut of Eshet Chayil traits. Now, we have succeeded in talking about Eshet Chayil for the last, 10 minutes or more, without ever mentioning Mishlei chapter 31. The Eshet Chayil poem consists of the last 21 verses of the 31st parak in Mishlei. I would argue that Mishlei 31 is at least partially about Ruth. In order to understand that, you have to look at Mishlei chapter 31, the beginning of the chapter. I wrote on your sheet in source number 4, I gave you the references for the text, but I think what I'm going to do is call it up on my computer. Having moved over to Or Chaim and not having brought my Tanakh with me, there are Tanakhs here, but I didn't think to set it aside before the shir, so I'm just going to use my computer and I will share the screen so that everybody can see it that way. Okay. All right, it's showing up on your screen?
Yes.
So the beginning of chapter 31. Divrei Lemuel Melech, the words of King Lemuel, and the sages and Midrashim all talk about Lemuel being Shlomo. I gave you one example of it, the Gemara in Brachos in source number 5, which identifies Shlomo as the speaker here, even though it mentions King Lemuel. But the key part is the end of the sentence. Masa means, we saw this when we learned Yeshayahu together, a harsh prophecy, a harsh message. Asher Yisarto Imo, which his mother rebuked him with. In other words, what we are about to read is Shlomo's mother rebuking him. Now, who is Shlomo's mother? Sorry? Bathsheba, correct. So let's give her a name. Bathsheba is instructing Shlomo. If you take a look on your sheet, you'll see I brought you Ibn Ezra. Betchilat haSefer hodia ki Yisrael aviv al haChokhma. The beginning of the book of Mishlei of Proverbs said that his father rebuked him for wisdom. V'siper kan, and here it says, Sheyisarto imo Bathsheba achar mot aviv lelamdo chokma. His mother Bathsheba rebuked him after his father died, in order to teach him wisdom. So that's what's going on here, is Bathsheba is trying to educate Shlomo. And she says the following in sentence 2. Ma biri, uma bar bitni, ume bar nidarai. Remember, the word ma, we've said, is often an exclamation. It isn't the question word what. It's an exclamation. My son, the son of my womb, the son of my vows. I'm not going into the whole association of vows and Bathsheba. Not relevant for us here. What's relevant is what comes next. She says to him in sentence 3, don't give your strength in the pursuit of women. Don't pursue wine. Wine is not good for kings. You drink, you forget what your role is, you warp the justice of the needy. In sentence 6, you want to give strong drink to somebody, give it to someone who is lost. Give it to someone who is a bitter spirit. He will forget his misery. Your job, sentence 8, sentence 9, open your mouth for the mute. Open your mouth and do justice. That's what Bathsheba says is the job of the king. That's her statement to Shlomo. And then the very next sentence, Eishes Chayil Mi Yimtza, and so on. I would like to suggest, and here I'm out on a bit of a limb, but I don't think it's too far at all, that the opening part of the chapter is not all that Bathsheba said, but rather the whole rest of it, Eishes Chayil, is still Bathsheba speaking. It's still Bathsheba talking. She's trying to describe for Shlomo, she already said, don't pursue women. Now she's saying, this is who you should be pursuing. Eshet Chayil is the one you're supposed to be going after. I gave a shiur years ago on this, trying to show parallels between Mishlei 31 and Ruth. In source number 7, I gave you a link where you can find that. I think what she's doing in various lines here is actually describing Shlomo's great-grandmother. You want to find a woman like your great-grandmother. You want to find a woman who's going to be like Ruth. And maybe we could suggest, and now we're really out on a limb, that maybe that's why in Kohelet Shlomo says, I couldn't find one woman in 1,000. Because he spends his life looking for another Ruth. That's not something you just find. It doesn't work that way. In fact, take a look at Malbim in source number 8. When I gave that shiur years ago, I quoted something at the end of the shiur that I had seen mentioned in the name of Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. But I was never able to find it in Rav Hirsch. And the more I look, the more I think that it's not Hirsch. I think it was this Malbim. Take a look at what the Malbim says. I think this is what the person who quoted it was saying. V'yesh misha nafsha mukhenes lemidos tovos utchunos meusharos mitolada. You have some people who are just good people from birth. They have positive attributes, they have good traits, and it's just the way they are. V'yesh misha nafsha tikna midos tovos utchunos meusharos yedei limud vehergel. Then there's the rest of us. And the rest of us become good by study. The rest of us become good by practicing good behavior. That's the way it works. Al harishon amar, eishes chayil mi yimtza. So for the first one, he said, a woman of chayil, who can find? Shezeh domeh kemotzei mitziah b'li yegia kapayim. Because it's like finding. You didn't have to work at it. You got good traits. Just, you fell into it. You got lucky. Val hasheni amar, v'rachok mipninim mimichrav. For the second one, it says, Her worth is far greater than pearls. Shemisha rotza liknos osa yedei amal vehishtadlus hi rechoko yoser mipninim. If you're going to try to achieve that by working at it, that is more expensive than pearls. Shemekomam b'mitzulos yam rechokim, which are found in the depths of the sea, v'tzarech lavor yamim rechokim v'laredes limkim mitzulos. You have to traverse the seas. You have to go down into the depths. Kein tsarich al zeh zman rav u'masim rabim v'laredes le'imkei tahom hanefesh lotzia kochos hameshubachos hanistarim babi mitzulosah u'lidlosam v'lidlosam al panei chutz. He says, you want to achieve chayil? Oh, is that going to be work? That's going to be a lot harder. So what Malbim is saying is that the traits of chayil are more elusive than pearls for one who doesn't have the good fortune to be born into it. And what I think this person was claiming Hirsch said was, Eishes Chayil mi yimtza, you don't find Eishes Chayil. You have to earn it. That I think is what this person was saying Hirsch. Anyway, the point here is that there's a lot that you can see within Mishlei Lamed Aleph, before you get to the Malbim and everything else, that is about Ruth. It fits with her career, because she is this person of Chayil. And now turn it around, because Boaz was also called Gibor Chayil. Boaz also has these traits. His righteousness and his strong positive character, you saw the chesed in the field, his restraint in the granary, his concern, mi'at, who are you, asking that question. Physical strength we don't know about for Boaz. By the time we meet him, he's already older. He is out there for the winnowing and all that himself, which is impressive. But we don't really know anything about his physical strength. Wealth? Sure seems like it. And respected social standing? Watch what happens with him in chapter 4, where he runs the show at the city gate. So Boaz is also this person of chayil, as is Ruth. You follow? So that's what we mean when we use this term, chayil. Yes, Susan.
I'm just a little troubled, and I'm sure you're going to set me straight, that Boaz is in his 80s. Okay, we said Ruth is in her 40s.
We don't know Boaz's age. The only thing that we know from the text is that he says to her, wow, you went with somebody who's old instead of going with somebody younger. And the Medrash says he's 80.
Oh, so it's just the Medrash that says he's 80.
Don't say just. Don't say just to me about Medrash.
Sorry, I
not unless you want me to go on a rant and then we won't learn anything else today. Yeah,
no,
go ahead.
No. What I meant was that I didn't remember reading it in the text.
Yeah.
And the Midrash is important. So therefore, if we take that he's that old, we'll take the Midrash, it doesn't seem to bother anybody but me that, is there something wrong with this relationship? Is she waiting for him to die? I mean...
So that is exactly where we're going next. That's where we're going next. So Susan, just hang in there.
Okay.
Rose.
No,
we didn't say four children. We said if the Medrash says he's Ibtzan, he had 60 of them.
Oh, 60.
There's a difference there.
But he had a lot of children. So even if he has one a year, but I mean, you just got to do the numbers.
Oh, he's not having one a year. Not with 60 of them.
He's
got multiple wives. Yeah,
so
he had multiple wives. There's no way you get to 60 that way otherwise.
Twins and triplets.
So,
wrong with 30 wives and
no, not
children
no, no 30. There were no 30 wives discussed ever. They
Ibtzan had 30 wives and they all died.
No, Ibtzan had 30 sons and 30 daughters. We did not say how many wives.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. Okay. So, I wanted to address this question, not so much in terms of the age, but the overall question of what drives this shidduch between Boaz and Ruth. What exactly is driving this whole thing? So you could argue, as Dr. Ziegler does in source number 9, and I see that I didn't translate it. That's odd. I missed it. I'm sorry. But I'll read it out and translate it as we go. She makes the argument that this match between Boaz and Ruth is one about responsibility. They're doing what they're supposed to do. It's not about love. She says, Ba'od parshanim mesuyamim ro'im b'sipur zeh sipur ahava. She says, certain commentators do see here a love story. Ha'megila atzma nimnat bi'ikviyut meharimizot ha'mikrayot ha'mikubalot la'ahava v'romantika k'shimata'eret et ha'yachsim ben Ruth u'Boaz. When the text describes the relationship between Ruth and Boaz, the text consistently avoids the type of language that we're used to seeing to describe love. The word love is never used. There are no gestures like it here. Anu motzim b'neihem kavod, we find honor and respect. Ha'aracha, we find esteem, right? Describes Ruth as an eshet chayil, and that's certainly a statement of esteem. Avalo regesh shel tshuka, but not a feeling of desire. Lemaaseh, she says, in practice, hamgila madgisha, shemarechet hayachasim bein Ruth uBoaz mevuseset al muchanut lekayem et mechuyavuyotehem. Wow. The Megillah emphasizes that the relationship between Ruth and Boaz is established on their willingness to fulfill their obligations. Gamim adavar karuch b'mechir ishi kaved, even if there will be a high personal price that they'll have to pay. L'chol achad mehem yeshna sibat tova lihimana milaseit et hasheni. Each of them has a good reason not to go through with this. Boaz yachol lahaseis ubetzedek shken Ruth hi moavia. Boaz could hesitate and say, you know, she's a Moabite, and even if Moabites are permitted, what's this going to look like? what problems is this going to create for me? Minikudat hamabat shel Rut, and from Rut's perspective, Boaz einenu efsharut rutsuya biglal gila mevugar. Boaz is not exactly a great option because, as has been noted, he is older, significantly older, old enough that he says, why in the world do you want to marry me? Kechelek mitzkuvato lefituya shel Rut, as part of his response when Ruth is approaching him, Boaz modeb meforash bekach, he says it explicitly. So, what Dr. Ziegler thinks is that this is not about love, but rather this is about responsibility. And that's an argument for sure. But I'm going to go a different route, so to speak. That was not intentional. I'm going to try a different way. Those who learn Shmuel in our Thursday afternoon shiur know that Yehonatan is enamored of David. From the beginning of Perek Yuchet, the beginning of chapter 18, Yehonatan is enamored of David, and the text does not say why. Right? So much so, Pirkei Avot says, it was not dependent on any specific thing at all. It was just there. But one clear element in that relationship is that Yehonatan and David both manifest the same admirable traits. Specifically, Emunah, that Hashem is going to take care of them no matter what, right? No matter what, God's going to manage things. Don't worry about it. David is willing to go running out to battle with Goliath without a second's thought. Yehonatan is willing to attack the Plishtim and not worry about what's going to happen afterwards. They are both impulsive in acting on that emunah, and Hashem, in fact, is with them. Hashem takes care of both of them. Here also, so what my point is not to say that those traits are found in Rut and Boaz. My point is to say that essentially they admire in each other that which they value themselves. You have somebody like Yehonatan who values in himself this faith in God. That's what he considers his north on his compass. And he sees David as somebody who lives his life the same way. And that's what attracts him to David. They are kindred spirits. Ruth and Boaz are presented to us as kindred spirits. They are both people of Chayil. Right? That's exactly it. We never see Ruth describe Boaz. Ruth never says something descriptive about him, just that you recognized me, you gave me an identity like we talked about. Boaz, though, praises Ruth multiple times for the traits that he possessed. He praises her for what she did for Naomi, even as he is a person who does for others. He praises her for coming to Judaism and the Jewish people. He is a zaken at the gate. He is an elder of the city, a shofet even. He praises her as a person of chesed. He says, everyone knows you are an eshet chayil, traits which are associated with him. So I would argue that while Dr. Ziegler is undoubtedly correct that both of them in doing this are fulfilling an obligation, nonetheless, there is a relationship here based on that which they have in common at the core of their identity. Yes, Susan.
The other
ones? They're gone. They're dead.
They're dead?
Yeah. Remember we talked about the funeral for his wife on the day that they show up in town, and that's why...
That was one of them. You had to have a few more.
Yeah, I know. We don't learn about them. But I would assume this.
I know the Torah looks down on, although they have it, on having more than one wife.
The Torah never shows a successful case of it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I was wondering here in this, like the other wives are in this picture at all, because we definitely know
they're not. Yeah. No, it looks like they're not here. And okay. On balance, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
I hate to say that. That means they're dead. I mean, unless they got divorced, I don't know. Okay. Ruchama, I still can't hear you. I don't know what to tell you, except, are you using a Samsung? You know what, Ruchama? Why don't you try going out of the Zoom and then coming back in? Maybe that will help. Okay. Okay, Moish.
You know, you've just described love perfectly. Seriously. Hmm. Well, however you want to, you know, in all the different ways, but the core of love is love that is unconditional and is for its sake only, that is to say, for the sake of love, not necessarily another person, but for the sake of love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what romantic love is. That's what it's exactly about.
Interesting.
So you perfectly described love.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. All right. Other thoughts on this, or should we go on to the six barleys?
Yeah.
Okay. Six barleys it is. So if you look at the end of our chapter, okay, sentences 15 to 18. So this is after they've had their conversation, and after Boaz has said, I don't want anybody to know. We talked about that last time. Vayomer, he says there, Havia mitpachat asher alayich. Give me your kerchief, right? Evidently, she did not show up expecting a gift. She didn't bring something to put grain into. So give me your kerchief. Ve'achaziba, and hold on to it. Vatochezba, which she did. Vayamad sheish se'orim. And he measured out, as the text says, six barleys. I may ask you for your translations shortly, but right now, just noting six barleys. Vayashes aleha, and he put it on her. Vayavo ha'ir, and he went off to the city. Vatavo el chamosa, and she, you know, he's going to the city because he's going to take care of everything. That's the idea. He's moving on this. Vatavo el chamosa, and she comes back to her mother-in-law. Vatomer mi'at biti, and her mother-in-law says, "Who are you, my daughter?" But it's not a "Who are you?" like "Who are you?" It's "Who are you now? Did my plan work? Are you now with Boaz?" Vatagela is kalashara salah ish. So she told her everything that the man did. Vatomer, and she gets to the end of the story. Sheish haseorim ha'ela nasanli. He gave me these six barleys. Ki amar, I'm adding in the word elai. You know, even though it's not written there, that's a topic for next week. Because he said to me, al tavoi rekam al chamosech. Don't show up empty-handed. Don't go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And vatomer shvi biti ara shoteidin echi pol davar. Just sit tight until we know where things are. Kilo yishkod ha'ishkim kila davar hayom. He will not be silent unless the matter is concluded today. Okay. So the question here is, what's the deal with these six barleys? What exactly is this about? So just for your own awareness of measurements, because we're going to be talking a little bit about them. According to the Dot Mikra edition, Professor Meltzer, a se'ah volume measure is about 36 liters of grain. Okay, this will matter. A se'ah is about 36 liters of grain, a liter of the volume measure. An ephah is 3 se'ah. So back in chapter 2, sentence 17, when she collected and she ended up with ke'efah se'orim, like an ephah of barley, that was 108 liters of grain. Okay? That's a lot of grain. There's a one other measure which we'll need to know, which is an isaron. An isaron is 1/10 of an ephah, or 10.8 liters. So your big one is the ephah, 108. The se'ah, 36 liters. The isaron, 10.8 liters. Got it? Susan, you look perplexed.
Aren't these liters, it's like liquid.
No, I mean, it is, we use it as a liquid measure, but for them it was just a volume measure.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, that's why I was confused.
Okay. So, simple read of this story is that Boaz is giving her food as a present, right? Just like the report that you get where, you know, Ruth says to Naomi, he told me I shouldn't come back to you empty-handed. So read it as just giving her food. And in fact, we could see messages in the food that relate to what happened and did not happen that night. if Naomi really expected Boaz to consummate the relationship that night, right? And that's why she asks mi'at biti, right? Wondering, did something happen? So Boaz knows that Naomi is going to be disappointed and worried. It didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? So the gift is to tell her, don't worry about it. Everything's okay. He's sending food as a message. We're good. Further, Malbim says that when Boaz says to Ruth, tell your mother-in-law that this is just so you don't go back empty-handed. Take a look in the sheet at source number 10. Vatomer sheish ha'serim ha'ela nasan li velo l'shem kiddushin. It wasn't for kiddushin. He's telling her, this wasn't kiddushin. Rak amar al tavoi reikam. Just don't show up empty-handed. Rotza lomar sheyi alanu sudas haboker. We should have breakfast. That's all it is. So one way to look at this gift is that it's just food. And that's the starting point of the Gemara. Take a look at source number 11, please. The Gemara in Sanhedrin. My sheish ha-se'orim. What are these six barleys? Ilema sheish se'orim mamash. If you're going to tell me it is just six stalks of barley, that's all it is. Six stalks of barley. V'chi darko shal boaz litein matana sheish se'orim. What kind of cheap guy is he? Six stalks of barley? Here, go chew on this. You know, what kind of a present is that? Ela sheish se'in. So the Gemara says, no, it's six se'ah. Now, since we went through the math, you now know that six se'ah would have to be somewhere around 216 liters of grain. That is way too much grain. I don't care if Ruth is Superwoman. That's way too much grain. V'chidarka shel isha litol sheish se'in. She's lugging home six se'ah of grain? And you wanted her to be discreet when she left the granary while you're at it? What in the world are you, people are going to think she stole the entire field? Ella, remez ramaz la, rather he was giving her a hint. And we're going to come back to what that hint was in a minute. But the Gemara's starting point is, it must be that this was food. Ibn Ezra is very comfortable with the idea that this was just food. Ibn Ezra says it was six stalks of barley. Yeah, that's all it was. Professor Meltzer in the Dot Mikra floats the idea that it was six isaron. Right? We said an isaron is 10.8 liters, so it's about 65 liters. Within her weight class still. So that's one way to look at this as it's food. Whether it is six stalks of barley, whether it is six se'ah, or six isaron, that's one way to take it. Without looking at commentaries, just in your translations, do your translations tell you is six stalks, or six isaron, or six measures? What do they do?
Six measures.
Yeah, that's a good cop-out. Right? If you just write six measures, then you don't have to explain which measure it is. Yes, Susan?
Mine says that he measured out six barleys and placed them.
So, six barleys. Okay, yeah, we have
no idea.
I don't
know what a barley is.
Well, that's the thing. You have to end up being six stalks. Yes, Gita? You have to unmute.
Okay, can you hear me now?
I hear you now, yes.
Oh, Baruch Hashem, okay.
Okay, so it says here, this is Sancino.
Yes.
60 barley, that is 285, too heavy a load for a woman to carry.
Yeah, wait, so yours, yeah, you're looking at commentary. I'm just asking on the text itself, how do they translate it?
Six barleys, yeah.
Six barleys, okay. So, you know, you can say it's six stalks and it's food. You could say that. Six se'ah, the Gemara dismisses. Six isaron, Professor Meltzer. But we have a few hints in the text that indicate that this is not really about food. It's not...
There's a lot of attention paid to hold the, you know, take a kerchief and hold it, and she did it. Like, they could have just said he gave it to her. There's some code.
There's something going on here. Not only that, in Pasuk Ted Vav, in sentence 15, did you notice the verb that was used? No, the verb for him giving it.
Vayamed.
What is Vayamed? What does that word mean? What, it's just simple. Vayamad is?
Nida, he measured out.
He measured out. If it's six stalks of barley, you don't measure them, you count them. Right? You should have said Vayispor. Or you should have said Vayitain. Vayamad is a measurement, that's interesting. And then, in sentence 17, I said to you that she retold everything that had happened, and then the last thing, the six barleys. Maybe. But isn't it odd that we single out this one thing? Like, from all the things that he did, we made a big deal about him asking mi'at. You could have mentioned that. Single that out. Oh, by the way, look, six barleys. Like, Ruth, you're a sophisticated, righteous person. You're getting hung up on the barley he gave you. Not only
let
that.
Let me just ask you,
yeah.
Why do they keep on calling him Ha'ish and not Boaz? Why don't they mention him by name here?
Interesting.
On two or three occasions, okay?
Yeah. I mean, Megillat Ruth does that from time to time with identifiers. So you see it with Naomi also. Not with Naomi, with Ruth. Where was it? I feel like back in the field, we also lost her name at one point. Am I just imagining that? No, well, it was Na'ara, but that was when the Na'ar was speaking. I don't know. It's a good question. Rose.
So I don't understand. You know how we talk about the six bodies? Okay, if it was just six bodies, you take it in your hand and you go. But in English, they say, he says, hold up the shawl you are wearing.
Yeah.
And then she held it and he measured out.
Right.
Doesn't that sound like rain, like you're measuring out six measures?
Yeah, well that's the problem. And not only that, let's get even more annoying here as I do our close read. Take a look at sentence 17. This will ring a bell for those who are learning Shmuel with me. Do you remember we had our discussion about Shloshet Hachitzim? The three arrows? Notice here, Sheish Haseorim Ha'ele. Hannah is smiling. Yes, you noticed that. These six barleys, right? It could mean these six. It could mean the six. And I have an indirect problem. In sentence 18, how is it that that Naomi knows that Boaz is going to take care of it that day?
And he only gave her enough food for one day?
So good. So Sandra is mechaven to the Malbim. We're not going to get to it today, but if you look down the page of the Malbim in source 13, yes, he only gave them food for a day, and not only that, for a meal. But we'll see that when we get there. I'm going to give you now the two explanations that go beyond saying this is food. We'll look at it more in depth next week, God willing, and then we'll also see the Kri Uktiv discussion, God willing, next week. That's going to be fun. You will then realize, once you see what we do next week, you will understand why there are yeshivas where they ban Abarbanel. If you look ahead on the sheet at what Abarbanel says, you might be moved to do the same. But basically, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which we read part of in source number 11, is going to say it's not about food. It's a hint about descendants that she is going to have, who are going to be blessed with six blessings. Six descendants who get six blessings. So it's a hint to the future. No, I said to you in the beginning this week that I didn't translate the sources that are at the end because I knew we weren't going to get there. The other approach is from Malbim. And Malbim is the one who's going to say it's specifically one meal's worth, and it's this... it's 6 liters, one kav. It's meant to be one meal's worth. And the reason why is because he wants to tell Naomi, I'm taking care of it today. Just like what Sandra just said before, he's only giving enough food for now to say, by the time you finish this food, we'll be on our way. So there's more to talk about with each of these. I want to unpack them, God willing, next week. So that will be our starting point, and next week should be a lot of fun. This Kri Uktiv thing, I'm telling you, from one end to the other, trying to explain this one. This is going to be a blast. Okay? Thank you very much, everyone. and have a good week. And Chana, again, Mazal Tov.
Thank you.